This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio with Donal Kavanagh. A very good morning to you. It is the second hour of the show, 10 past 10. Let's take a look at some of your comments in the first hour. We were speaking to Deputy Marion Harkin about her motion that's coming before the Dáil to improve the carer's allowance. Caller says, because I received my pension, I was cut to half-rate carers. My husband has Alzheimer's. I am a full-time carer. One caller was asking with regards to children with special needs, because a caller said earlier that they don't qualify for carer's allowance because their child was quite ill. Deputy Harkin said that children under 16 carers don't qualify for carer's allowance, but they can get other allowances. Another caller then says, yes, you can get allowances for children under 16 as long as you qualify for domiciliary carer's allowance. But the advice I would give to anyone wondering about that is contact either your local TD or indeed contact the Citizens Advice Information Centre or go online and get some advice on that, because there is funding, and that's what Deputy Harkin said. Look, if anyone make contact with herself or with their own local TD and they'll explore what options are available if you find yourself in that position. Caller says, I travelled 20 miles a day to care for my sick ageing parents, including hospital visits, travelling to chemists to get prescriptions, food, etc. Got nothing from the state, was told I had to reside with them. And that's a situation that many people do find themselves in. Another caller says, if a carer does not live with the person they care for, they can't claim fuel allowance for themselves. Another caller says, carers should get the minimum wage, as the allowance isn't enough. If it were treated as a job and got the minimum wage, then things might be better. Another caller says, Caroline says, work 7 days a week, I get a reduced rate. I work part-time because I have children and I have to feed them and look after them. It can't be stated how tiring this is. And Caroline then goes on to say it's true that partners' money should not be brought into this whatsoever, and saying that if you have to take someone on an appointment to Dublin from Donegal, well, you know, €110 won't even cover the cost of that trip, never mind expenses over the course of the rest of the week or whatever. Other issues we spoke in the first hour with regards to those potholes on the Mill Road in the vicinity of Ballybuffet, and the fact that a sign went up at the weekend, humorous sign, fasten your brass wraps, take out your dentures, potholes ahead. It was funny, but the point was made that it took a funny sign to get this issue highlighted. Caller says it's all a matter of priority where the money is spent on. There have been some money gone on white elephants in Donegal, the Blaney Bridge being mentioned again. Yet on the rest of Fannin's roads, I've seen more tar and a packet of cigarettes. The authority need to cater for the needs of all road users, not just a few. Now, the Moville Community College, potential good news this morning, we're told, with regards to a new college building. Now, we've heard so much about Moville Community College over the years, and there have been issues with it. Hopefully, there are indications, and all we can say is indications at the moment, that those issues may be on the verge of being resolved. If that is the case, that is excellent, and we will hopefully get confirmation on that. But it is something we're looking into, and hopefully we'll get more clarity on that question. During the paper review, we spoke about the Kerry Babies case. I did say that I am of an age that I was in college and 1920 when this became the biggest story in the country. And it's a story that certainly has stayed with me and has stayed with many, many people, I think, for the decades since, when you look back on the whole Kerry Baby story and say, how did that happen? It was just a very, very strange time in Ireland socially, as well as that particular story. It has to be said there were some other rather horrendous stories broke around that sort of same period in the early 80s as well. Well, Tom Inglis is a sociology professor in University College in Dublin. He now joins us on Zoom. Tom, a very good morning to you.
Good morning. Yeah.
So you wrote
just to follow up on that, I was in the States when the Kerry Baby story broke, and I was writing about the things like the power of the Catholic Church, and I was particularly interested in the way about, you know, sexual repression. So I came at this story in relation, because I thought it was weird that, you know, an extramarital affair in which a woman was deliberately not using contraceptives, and I thought, this is a very interesting story, and it explains to me, or shone a light on me, and how kind of weird and different Irish society was from the States, you know, where which I had experienced, if you like, a much more openly sexual society. And I began to, you know, think about it, and then I began to study it. And then I realized it was about so much more. I mean, it wasn't just about, say, in a way, the Catholic Church plays a part, but because of the abortion referendum, etc. But that's in the background. And they don't actually get involved in any kind of moral condemnation of Joanne Hayes. But I began to realize it was about a story about Ireland. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, as a sociologist, you know, you can get people and you can just kind of bewilder them with, you know, with theories and facts, but it's much better to tell a story. And in the same way, when I grew up in the, you know, in the 1950s, I heard these stories about the Holocaust, and I had no idea. And then slowly but surely, I realized that the Holocaust was the biggest story to have happened in, you know, 20th century in the world. And but I think, and without making any kind of injudicious comparisons, but there is the reason why we come back to the Kerry babies, because it was a watershed. You know, things happened then that have not happened since. And, you know, when I explained to my daughter, who and she just got kind of goes, and she's now, you know, in her 30s, and she grew up, she was born in, you know, 1988, and, yeah, and she just can't get her head around. And so I think there is this kind of thing of her by, you know, we're saying to young people, you've got to understand that if you want to understand what happened in Ireland in the 1980s, the best way to do it is to understand this weird, wild, you know, incomprehensible story about what happened to Joanne Hayes.
I have colleagues here in the newsroom who were not born when that happened. I am substantially the oldest person in this department. And as I say, I was in college when all this was happening, so I was very aware of it. And I was trying to explain to one of my colleagues there on Friday, when this all started to break on Friday, I said, yeah, here's what happened, I said, in a nutshell, as far as I recall it. In a nutshell, this baby's body was found horribly mutilated on a beach in County Kerry. Mm-hmm. Gardaí sat down and made a list of all the pregnant women in the area, and tried to figure out which of those pregnant women might have been the child's mother. Eventually, they focused on a young lady called Joanne Hayes, who lived, I mean, about 80 kilometres, 50 miles away, as it would have been at the time. She was pregnant. She was unmarried. She had given birth to a baby. But someone, a Garda, if I recall, came up with a theory of, if I'm pronouncing it right, superfecundity. And the theory was that she had had sex with two men in quick succession and gave birth to twins by two different fathers.
Well, yeah, that was developed in the tribunal. What happened to the, when they were looking around? And, when people say it was a witch hunt, the idea that there was a local Gardaí started to do this investigation. They went out looking for a woman who'd been pregnant and who was no longer pregnant, given birth. And there was local, and then they decided, hey, look, we're not moving anywhere. So they bring down the murder squad. Like, the murder squad were the elite. These were the people who were interrogating the provisionals and Republicans, and they wouldn't talk. And they had developed ways and means of getting hardened criminals, hardened Republicans to talk, to confess. Just so happens that three of these guys are from Kerry. So they see, you know, this idea of a baby being stabbed to death as a blot on the Kerry, you know, kind of reputation and honour. So they decide, we'll go down and we'll sort this out. So they go down and they hear about Joanne Hayes. They go out to the farm and they find Joanne Hayes, and they bring her in and her rest of the family. And within, you know, 24 hours, they've all confessed to having stabbed this baby, to having dumped the baby in the sea. The baby gets washed up in Carrisaveen, and all done and dusted, and off they go. And the only problem then was that they eventually persuaded her sister to, Joanne was in custody, and the guards go out and they find a baby on the farm. Oh, right. So then they decided that the baby had twins, because it could not be possible that she had confessed and her family had confessed to a crime that they didn't commit. because that would have been a blur on the reputation of the guards. So they decided, okay, here, what we're going to do now is we have to come up with a theory. And the theory, as you said, is that Joanne Hayes had sex with two different men. That's okay. Well, no problem. She gave birth to twins. Ah, problem. The twins are a different blood group. What? The twins are a different blood group. So what does that mean? Well, that means that she must have had, to have given birth to twins, she must have had sex with two different men. But one baby's is a blood group, sometimes the other one's a blood. Well, she has to have done this within 48 hours. Oh, so she's going around. She's in madly in love with this guy Jeremiah Locke. She's engaged in a kind of a competition to have more children with him than he is having with his wife, which is one of the reasons I got interested in the case. And then the guards came up with, no, what happened was that she had twins with two different men. And so that she was kind of this wanton woman who was going around Kerry having sex with anybody and everybody she could find. And of course, the DPP, said, OK, this is dodgy, and withdrew the case when it came to. And again, it was only because of two things. One was the investigative reporters, the media, that they picked up in the case. And the second thing we must remember, if the twins had been of the same blood group, then Joanne Hayes would have been incarcerated, and she would have and the whole family would be have lived with this shame. So it was pure chance that it was different. But it wasn't pure chance that the media, not the state, but the media came in and said, something's gone wrong here. Why was this case withdrawn? And that was, those two things were pivotal this story to emerge, which is still for me, in the latter half, how Ireland changed in the latter half of the 20th century. The Kerry babies shines a huge light on how different Ireland is today compared to what it was then.
But it shows how long it took, because Joanne Hayes formally received a formal apology and a settlement of 2.5 million from the state, not a year after this, not 2 years after this, not 10 years after this, but in 2020, effectively more than almost 40 years after the events, Joanne Hayes finally got an apology and recompense she went through.
There's many different stories you can tell about this. One is I go on about the honour and respect of the guards, the honour and respect of the family, but for me, I spent a lot of my life trying to understand what the Catholic Church did to me. Now the Catholic Church has done many wonderful things, but it made me and a lot of other generations sexually repressed, and now I'm in my 70s and I'm trying to understand what that was about. But this is not just a question about what the Catholic Church. It's also a question, in a weird way, about what the state can do to you. Now, we don't have a theory of the state. We go on about what the church did to us. But in a way, what happened in there was the guards came down, extracted a confession. Mm-hmm. Then the state set up a tribunal. Well, the tribunal was, in a way, another form of a witch hunt. You had all these men gathered in this courtroom interrogating this woman as if she was some kind of witch.
Yeah.
And then the state, in the sense of the judiciary, Judge Kevin Lynch, writes a report which says that the guards gilded the lily. They were, they exaggerated, whereas the Hayes family were wanton liars. And now what's happening, to my mind, is that, there is, after all this time, there is not just about, a vindication of what happened to the to Joanne Hayes, but there's also that the state is trying to, if you like, clear up its mess. And I think there is, I don't know what's happening at the moment, but having put so much time and effort into pursuing this case, and as everybody's saying now about getting justice for baby John, this is the Caris Iveen baby.
Yeah.
It may well be about that, but it's also about the state saying, yes, we messed up and now we are repairing the damage. So in a way, you know, this couple or whatever happened is a kind of becomes a scapegoat, you know, for the state to say, yes, as a state, we messed up. And we messed up from, you know, not just the guards, the judiciary, but also the government in the way that it didn't, as you said, apologise, quickly enough.
But even the truth of it is, though, even if what's happening at the moment, even if this fresh investigation and we'll park the people who have been arrested for this moment in time, because we, obviously we've got to park that. But the Gardaí now do have, we are led to believe, good, clear DNA samples from baby John. They have scientific samples, DNA that was not available to them at the time. Even if they do establish the parentage of baby John.
Yep,
even if they can, even if they can absolutely establish that woman A and man B are the parents of baby John, that is still a million miles away from in any way coming to a theory of how did baby John meet his death, because you cannot extrapolate. Well, they're the parents, therefore, you cannot make that leap. You still do not know.
And dare I say, the horrible thing is we're going to have to rely on confessions, as in the original case, because I don't think there's any good, any, if you like, even good circumstantial evidence, right? I mean, let alone that's something that would prove beyond reasonable doubt, which you need in a criminal court case, is highly unlikely. So all of this is, in a way, is about... trying to tie up loose ends. So there were so many loose ends to the Kerry babies, and this is an attempt, if you like, to square the circle. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure if that can be done, and I'm not sure if it'll serve any great purpose at this stage. I do feel the only thing I feel is that once again, it raises, you know, for Joanne Hayes, who has had to live with this, it raises, oh my God, here I go again. I know. Is there any chance? And I think that that's an unintended consequence, which is a. I do feel that in another way that it justifies that you know, all the time she said I wasn't, and now we've moved the case is away from her over to Cara Sivine, and what happened in that time. I sometimes ask myself. Why is this all happening? And I think, you know, just to go back to the point that you said earlier, one of the things is that if the state could have said, I'm sorry, we see this in medical negligence cases, you know, they drag on for years and just nobody said sorry. And for me, one of the things, there was one of the detectives in the Kerry babies before the DNA stuff came out, said, repeatedly said on public radio, on the airwaves, that he was convinced that Joanne Hayes. So you know, that hurt continued on for a long time afterwards, every time it came up. I don't think there was any peace and quiet for Joanne Hayes. And that's one of the unfortunate things that happens when you become, you know, like you're living in and then suddenly all hell breaks loose.
And we know she has been an intensely private person over the years, and, she has not. Did you get to speak to her? Your own book was Truth, Power and Lies. In terms of your writing, did you get to speak to the people at the centre of this? Did you get to speak to Joanne Hayes?
No, I didn't. And she was, and I got, you know, Pat Mann, her solicitor. And again, I spent 10 years, you know, obsessed with this. And of course I would have loved... I mean, there are loose ends still. You know what happened in the family farm that night. There's a lot of speculation, and of course only Joanne Hayes knows. But I admire her because I'm sure she could have got a lot of money as well as for telling her side of the story. There's still documentaries being made about the Kerry babies. I mean, there has been by RT. There's others in the pipeline. So you know this story. You know, whether it becomes a film or whether it becomes it'll go on for definite. None of the guards would talk. I mean, this is the, one of the things I'm about this, how tight-knit the guards were. They're one for all for one. They all told the same story. They all went into the tribunal. You know, man after man, and said the exact same things, and it was a fabrication. something happened that this family confessed to crimes in detail, in minute details, you know, with fantastical journeys made, you know, to tie up the loose ends, you know, and it was all a fabrication. And to say that, and Justice Lynch to say that that the Hayes family made up these stories to satisfy the guards, that it had nothing got to do with intimidation, nothing, and that then the guards, none of them would come out and say, this is what happened in that station that night. So there is always this sense of cover up, of you know, the honor and reputation of the guards, that nobody has broken the silence.
Yeah.
And this is one of the, you know, the things that happens in a legal situation when we live in a legal society, you know, that nobody can confess and say, sorry, this is what happened, I'll be honest.
And we are now at the point, we are now at the point where, you know, what happened in that room, it was almost 40 years ago when it happened. It happened in 1984. That's 36 odd years ago. Now, I don't know the people that were in the room at the time, but I mean, one would presume that at least some of the Gardaí who may have been involved in that may have passed away since then. I think it's probably a fair assumption to make that at least some may have passed away. If that's the case, we've sometimes seen in tribunals in the past that you effectively and forgive the bluntness with which I say this, you blame it on the dead guy.
And there was a certain element of that. One of the senior lead detectives in the case blamed, you know, the head Courtney, and said that, you know, he wanted to go out and search in the field, and if they had found the baby in the field, the whole thing would have been dropped. But because he was, so there's, because internal blame, you know, shit, you know, I wanted to do it, no, but it was his fault, etc. But it is that sense of there was somebody in Kerry knew what happened to that baby. Now, you know, mightn't have been the parents, as you say, it might be somebody else, but somebody else in there did stab that baby 28 times and broke its neck, and they have been willing to stand idly by while all of this shame and all of this hurt was caused to Joanne Hayes. That's where there is a guilt. Either somebody has left Joanne Hayes out to dry. They never said, even anonymously wrote and said, you know, I am this, you know, or whatever. But I mean, of course, and when I started to do this case, and somebody said to me, there are so many skeletons in so many cupboards in Ireland that people will not talk to, and they will not talk to you about them, and they will not tell you the truth about what happened. And I think that's why we don't get apologies, because you know, an apology suggests that you were guilty, or you know, that you did something wrong. So all the time we can't say sorry. Oh, it took the state so long to say, look, I'm sorry, Joanne, I'm sorry.
Tom Inglis, your own book is Truth, Power and Lies. As I said, it is, you know, for people who are new to this, it's a very important part in our history, and maybe an understanding of what happened back then. And hopefully, if it is possible to get closure on what happened back then, would be even better. But understanding of what happened in the 80s and before that is maybe a key part of understanding who we are as a society, and maybe where we came from as a society. And it's something that we can't just put to one side and pretend it didn't happen, because the Kerry babies happened, Granard happened, and Lovett happened, and that there are many things like that happened, and they are a part of our history, and it's a complex and complicated history. And books like your own hopefully help us make some sort of sense of it. But for the moment, Tom Inglis, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning.
Pleasure.
Thank you. That's Tom Inglis there. He is, as we say, a professor of sociology at UCD in Dublin. His book on the Kerry babies case, Truth, Power and Lies. Now, a caller has asked, with DNA, etc., can the baby's mother be identified now? That potentially may be the case. And that's what Gardaí are trying to do at the moment. But as we said in our conversation with Tom there, we cannot make that leap and say, if we identify who the parents are. And let's be honest, we can't just say, can the baby's mother be identified now? Let's say, can the baby's parents be identified now? Because there was a man involved in this as well. And God knows, and it was interesting when Tom said at the tribunal, man after man after man walked in. And I think that's a very telling phrase, because this was a story in which a myriad of men in various uniforms all ganged up to blame something on one woman. And I think we cannot lose sight of that truth.
Watch the show live now on YouTube, Facebook and at highlandradio.com.
It's the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. If you listen to news and indeed listen to the show over the past number of months, you'll be aware that there are serious questions with regards to the future of the local health centre in Letchamecha Ward. We know that the GP who previously worked in the health centre in Letchamecha Ward is now based in Glenties, and people from Letchamecha Ward have got to travel to Glenties to avail of that service. A petition has now been started in Letchamecha Ward to get this situation resolved. I'm joined on the line by Brenda Burns, a member of the Letchamecha Ward Health Centre Action Group. Brenda, good morning.
Good morning, Donal. How are you?
Very well indeed, thanks. It's great to speak to you this morning. We know that this has been an issue for a while. The HSC took a decision because of concerns over the state of the building in November that it was no longer fit for use. The big question now, of course, is when will we see it renovated, made fit for purpose and bring a local GP back to Letchamecha Ward again?
Well, that's exactly it, yeah. The health centre was closed on the 18th November, temporary closure. A report carried out last summer deemed the centre to be unsuitable. There was a few grounds mentioned in that report that made it unsuitable, and so a letter was sent to patients in early November that the health centre at Letchamecha Ward would close from the last day, would be the 18th November, temporary closure, and that they were keeping the situation under review, and there's been very, very little communication since, just that the situation is under review. Now, it's a vital service in our community.
Now, the HSE are telling you, and indeed they're telling us as well, that there are what they're calling significant deficits and significant investments will be required to bring the building in line with current standards. Now, there is no indication yet coming from the HSE as to when that significant investment is going to be made available and when those significant deficits are going to be addressed. The worry, I'm sure, is going to be that this is going to be put on the long finger, stay on the long finger, and it could be a substantial period of time before we actually see anything happen here.
Yeah, indeed, that is a huge worry for the community in Letchamecha Ward. There is a fantastic GP service being operated out of the primary care centre in Glenties by Dr. Charlie McManus. However, I mean, our health centre in Letchamecha Ward is a vital service that the health centre would be opened. We have a GP service, as I say, operating out of Glenties, but it would be vital that service is restored to Letchamecha Ward. I can't remember a time ever when we didn't have a GP situ in the health centre at Letchamecha Ward. Yeah, we haven't seen that report yet. We are hoping to be able to access that report shortly, and in conjunction then with the petition, we will decide where to go from there. But I think the petition we have over 400 signatures at the moment, and there is a real hunger for that service to be restored to Letchamecha Ward. But yes, there is definitely a fear. At the moment, we are working with the HSC. We hope to work with them in the future to try and either, you know, refurbish the health centre that is there or identify a new site for a new health centre. But whichever is the option, that we would have the health centre restored to Letchamecha Ward and that Dr. Charlie McManus would operate out of the health centre in Letchamecha.
In terms of the ultimate decisions, as you say, the HSC locally being supportive and no one doubts the bona fides of the HSC on the ground in Donegal. The question, of course, is very often these decisions aren't made by people on the ground who know Letchamecha Ward. These decisions are made by effectively bean counters in Dublin.
Absolutely. And that's why the public meeting was called, because I'm just one of a very large community, and we wanted to see what the public support was. That meeting was very well attended, and you know, obviously there is an absolute hunger there. There are issues with, as I say, a fantastic service being provided in Glenties by Charlie and his staff, absolutely amazing, but that involves travelling. For some people that's not an issue, but for others it is, who would have been able to access the service in Letchamecha Ward, the health centre, by walking to it or travelling to it would have been a lot easier. Now they're having, maybe some people are having to pay for transport, and we just don't have that vital service in terms of, you know, even emergencies. We don't have that vital service in the village, which we have. I mean, I always remember there being a GP in situ in that health centre. But yes, I think the idea of the petition was to convince the HSC and let them see that Letchamecha Ward, we really, really, really need this vital service restored to the area. And the petition was just the first step in getting that service restored. But we very much are looking forward to working with the HSE to restore the health centre that is there already.
And that petition, as you say, available in local shops around the area. You're looking at developing an online presence, and steps are being taken to actually put that into action.
Yeah, we have a Facebook page launched, Letter McGuard Action Group, and Letter McGuard Health Centre Action Group, sorry. And we've just basically that's for information, because I think information is key in situations like this. And a letter did issue to patients back in November, and since then we all accept that these things don't move quickly, they move slowly. And but just, I suppose, in keeping especially more vulnerable members of the community up to date with what is actually happening, because as well as being a vital resource and a vital service to the area, it is also rural communities need these sort of services to be retained in the community, because like rural society depends on these. Like we had the Letchmack Ward 9 years ago, we had to fight to keep our post office. So, you know, it's keeping these services. And as I say, primary care centres are fantastic, and the service that has been provided in Glenties is absolutely amazing, but it's not in Letchmack Ward, and that's where we need it to be from transport and point of view, and from even, you know, as I say, from an emergency point of view, we need that to be in the village.
Brenda Burns of the Letchmack Ward Health Centre Action Group, thanks for speaking to us this morning. The petition, as
thanks
we said, available in local shops, go online as well on Facebook, Letchmack Ward Health Centre Action Group. Get involved if you're in the area, and make contact with them. Brenda, we'll be speaking again in the future, I have no doubt. But in the meantime, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks a million, Donald. Thanks for your time.
Our pleasure. That's Brenda there in Letchmack Ward. Just a few of your comments before we go to a break. We were speaking earlier with regards to cyclists, and a caller says, race cyclists holding up traffic by riding two abreast on the road. What my partner and I do now is we walk two abreast in cycle lanes. Let's see how they like it. Whatever. Looking at the INMO, actually, just on cyclists, another caller said, cyclists should show some respect for drivers. A lot of the time they're cycling two abreast and drivers can't get by. As a driver living in a rural area, what are the rules in the sense of how many cyclists can cycle side by side? Quite often they come around a corner, there are two or three cyclists together side by side. And that's an issue that's been raised by a few people. And it does bear maybe mentioning that sometimes cycling issues in Dublin are different to cycling issues in rural areas. In rural areas, there is one issue in an urban area like Dublin. It can be a very different issue indeed. But that is it. It's a fair point. Now, INMO have just given us the figures for their trolley watch numbers of people awaiting beds this morning. As of 8 o'clock this morning, there were 44 admitted patients at Letterkenny University Hospital without beds. Of those, 15 were on trolleys in the emergency department, and 29 were elsewhere in the hospital in inappropriate settings, be it trolleys, be it unattended beds, be it chairs, whatever. So 44, the number of people in Letterkenny University Hospital without beds this morning. Take a short break. Back after this. Now, shocking video footage emerged showing a family of eight being evicted without notice from rented accommodation just days before St. Patrick's Day. The Brazilian-Portuguese couple evicted from their Donegal home were told that their children could be taken from them. Their father would be arrested for burglary. He was accused of stealing and taking drugs by a group of men who came unannounced to evict them after dark. Now we're joined on the line by a councillor, Sinead Maguire of Fine Gael, who has taken an interest in this. Councillor Maguire, good morning.
Good morning.
You've taken an interest in this issue. You're based in Sligo yourself, Sinead. This was a horrendous incident by all accounts.
Yes, it is. I am in contact with the family because they're now being sheltered in Sligo. And that's how I got involved with it. But as you've rightly said, they were evicted from a house in Bundoran completely illegally. There was no notice given whatsoever. They had signed a contract actually for 3 years, but were not given a copy of that contract. As you say, two men came in the back door, two men came in the front door at the same time. This is a family with six children, all under the age of 9 years old. I cannot believe and I cannot imagine how incredibly frightening and intimidating it must have been for them. The mother took the children upstairs and kept them in a bedroom while the four men packed up all of their belongings into black refuge bags and put them outside on the road in the rain, while the landlord proceeded to change the lock on the house so that they would no longer have the key. They were threatened that the water and electricity would be turned off. There were numerous allegations and threats thrown at them, which is ironic given the completely unlawful nature of what was happening to them.
Is there any legal action been taking on this? Because, as you say, not only is this morally reprehensible by all accounts, but it also is, given that there is an eviction ban in place in this country, at least until March 31st, what happened here was illegal.
Everything about it, though, is illegal, Donald. It really doesn't relate to the eviction ban. This is a landlord who decided to take matters into his own hands completely. He didn't provide them with a contract. He didn't give them notice. There's supposed to be a court process if you want to take back your property. That wasn't done. The Gardaí are supposed to be notified that wasn't done. He would have a right to appeal to the RTB. Now, he has taken that measure. But that could take a year. To get a resolution, and there is a maximum fine of €30,000 for that. But, that's really cold comfort to a family of eight who now find themselves homeless.
Does that then call into question what the efficacy of the legislation we have is at the moment? Because we can speak on the radio of how this was wrong, this was terrible, this was awful, but the fact is it happened, and the family who were evicted at this point in time are in emergency shelter and are not in what they thought was their home.
No, absolutely not. Initially, Donald, when I looked at this, I thought that perhaps that we needed greater Garda input. But I've subsequently discovered that there is a policy document on repossession and evictions, which sets out very clearly the steps that the Gardaí are supposed to take in these cases. Now, unfortunately, in this case, there were two separate calls put into the Garda. And these people, they're not native to Ireland. They're Brazilian and Portuguese couple. They're not familiar with our laws. This incredible event happened to them, and their first instinct was to call the guards. But the guards didn't intervene, although this policy document does ask them to carry out a risk assessment. It asks them to look at the legality of the repossession. It asks them to consider human rights concerns that are involved. And most particularly in this case, it refers to where there are children and vulnerable people that they need to be considered, particularly given their lack of ability to understand the process and procedures. So unfortunately, while that policy is in place and it refers to five different acts that would be covered, would cover this sort of what was absolutely illegal event, there was very little actual care given to this family.
Is this an indictment then of a system which claims to be geared toward caring for people, but ultimately appears to be, on the face of it, in this instance, at the very least, utterly and completely ineffective?
On this case, yes. I think this is, unfortunately, it's very timely, and we are now looking at a period where we have an eviction ban being lifted. And I would just hate to think that landlords thought that this sort of behaviour was acceptable or would be tolerated by any of the authorities. It's completely unlawful, and it should not be tolerated. And we need to protect people from this sort of incredible the video. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it really is shocking to see a family literally put out on the street in the dark, in the rain, their belongings put into black bags. They were told that a hotel room was booked for them. That was nonsense. There was no hotel room booked for them. Their belongings were actually withheld from them for a number of days before they got them back. And as I say, there are six children here, Donald, going down as far as 11 months old. It's just unconscionable that somebody, that four grown men thought that this was okay to do this to a family.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what the legal repercussions will be and what supports and what comforts are given to this family. But certainly at this point in time, it's an ongoing story. Councillor Sinéad Maguire, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. What's your view on this?
My
you
pleasure.
Can contact us, text us 086 60 25000, WhatsApp message us on that number as well, or you can call us. The number here on Highland is 074 91 25000.